Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare, science, and debate, dialogue. Who knows what will happen? Certainly, I have an idea, but you can change that with a stroke of your finger, so to speak, on the dial. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I have a number of stories I'm excited to get to. We have a couple of callers on the line. I'm going to ask them to wait patiently for a little bit, because I have to roll with this first one, because I have observed this over the years, and there's actually a biochemical reason for it. In a recent study that was done at the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University, researchers tracked men's testosterone levels and finally sort of definitively settled the question. After the birth of a child, men's testosterone levels drop. This study followed a large group of men who were not fathers, so it was a prospective study, which is the best way to get this kind of information, and monitored their hormone levels. When the men became fathers, their testosterone levels dropped. It was quite a significant drop initially when they first brought home a newborn baby. And even as they continued to be part of a family, these are generally new families where there hasn't been a child in the household, they remained low. They started to come back up, but they still stayed lower than the pre-birth levels of testosterone. Turns out men with a higher testosterone are more likely to father a child. I guess no one's too surprised about that. Testosterone in mammals leads to competitive, aggressive behavior, which, of course, if you happen to be, say, a ram or a stag, improves your chances of mating. On the other hand, the very traits that improve your chances of mating in humans, at least, where we are born very helpless and require full-time care for many years before we're independent, that's kind of a two-parent job, as any single parent will tell you. So, biologically hardwired, the testosterone levels drop. It'll be interesting to see whether caring for young children in a non-father situation, such as older brothers, let's say, or something along those lines, also reduce testosterone levels. But, you know, given the amount of testosterone toxicity that I see in young men in my practice, and then watch what happens when they do marry or not marry and have an infant, I was convinced this effect was there all along. Another couple of interesting stories. First of all, a little bit about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. This is an idea in physics that you can't really see an electron. You can't see quantum phenomenon easily, because in order to see them, you have to interfere with them, and therefore you change them. So you don't get to see a photon or an electron in its natural habitat, because you can't see it without messing with it. Well, it turns out that everything we know about cervical cancer may actually be wrong. Recent research done through pooling a lot of data in the European Union suggests that, among other things, IUDs actually are protective for cervical cancer. And what they found was that there's a 45% reduced risk for cervical cancer in women who have used IUDs. Now, of course, the researchers thought, well, maybe that's just because case finding, right? When women who get IUDs obviously have access to sophisticated medical care, they've had pap smears, so therefore we're just not putting IUDs in women who are precancerous lesions. We find those women by doing the pap smear and then treat them first. So only the ones who don't have cervical precancerous changes are going to get an IUD, and it's just case finding. Well, they went back and they massaged the data, and no. Not only that, it turns out that if you've ever had a cervical biopsy or any kind of cervical treatment to work against HPV, it turns out that the act of biopsying the cervix to determine whether or not you have precancerous changes actually sets up an immune reaction that, it would appear at least, takes care of those lingering residual HPV infections that might be floating around and eventually lead to cervical cancer if left alone. If you go to societies where there are no pap smears, therefore no colposcopies and no cervical biopsies, the lifetime risk for cervical cancer is about 6.5%. If you go to societies like ours where you have surveillance, the lifetime risk of cervical cancer is about 1%. So it may in fact be the case that our surveillance is actually therapeutic, and we never knew it. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle has been applied to quantum physics, but maybe inadvertently, we've been treating cervical cancer just by looking for it. An interesting thought. And we're going to go to our first caller who's been waiting patiently. It's Maria Elena in San Linus. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm calling on behalf of a friend. She has double vision.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, when she first wakes up in the morning, she has double vision. And for several years now, at night, when she's very tired watching TV or driving, she gets double vision. Now, if she's driving, she pulls over, closes her eyes for a few minutes, and then she's okay. But a few months ago, she took a very long car trip. It was about 6 hours, and she pulled over, closed her eyes, but it didn't work. It took about 4 or 5 hours for it to go away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the last 6 months, between 1 and 2 times a week at night, 99% of the time this happens at night, she has double vision. So it's increasing, it seems to be increasing. When she's tired, it happens with both eyes, covers one eye, and it goes away.
Right. Okay.
She went to an optometrist, gave her a test which showed that she had some sort of muscle problem. In fact, the optometrist told her that her eyes were crossing.
Right.
And that she had very, very unusual eyes. That was what he said. And she said, would eye exercise help? And he said, no, you're too old for that. It wouldn't do any good.
All right. Yes. Did she have problems in childhood with this double vision issue or crossed eyes that you know of?
I don't know.
It's a key question.
I think she would have said so, but no.
Yeah, it's a key, key question. Let's talk about in childhood. This is common in children. And what will happen is you're born with the eye muscles not being of equal strength. And so even though the brain is sending the signal to the eyes, the muscles are not able to line up properly. And this is also can happen in the opposite direction, where you have a problem with the focus of the eye, so the image isn't hitting the right place on the retina. That part of the eye doesn't develop because we need a focused image hitting our retina in order for our brain's neural connections for vision to actually develop properly. So in infancy, and up till about the age of 5, we have enough neuroplasticity for our retina and our occipital cortex to develop in concert. So sometimes we'll find children with crossed eyes, maybe at 2 years old, when they're finally old enough to pay attention to something, and we'll see, oh, one eye's crossing in, and we'll put glasses on those kids or patch their eye or do whatever's necessary to get the brain to develop properly. Now, so it is a given that people do develop, have different muscle lengths of their eyes, and we can operate on those muscles if we catch it in childhood. You could also acquire an eye muscle weakness. And if this didn't happen until adulthood, then an acquired eye muscle issue is certainly the most likely explanation for your friend's condition. Certainly it makes sense that she would have more problems at night because your eyes are tired at night. You had mentioned that she has this in the morning. And I want to ask, is it something that if she gets up, it dissipates after 15 or 20 minutes?
Yeah, that's my impression. Mm-hmm.
So that suggests to me, and this is purely hypothetical, but it makes sense and it fits with the mechanism here. She may have a tumor or some inflammation, and I don't know which, in one of her eye muscles, probably one of the lateral or medial rectus muscles. And you can think of the reins on a horse, okay? You've got the bridle, you've got the reins, you pull on the right, the horse's head turns to the right, the horse knows to go to the right. The eye is kind of like that. You've got these two muscles pulling back and forth on the eyeball, saying go to the right, go to the left. And if you don't get the commands on both eyes lined up exactly correctly, then you're going to have double vision. And anybody can play this game. If you take your finger at arm's length and then bring it forward and forward and forward, eventually you can't bend your eyeballs enough and you've got two fingers there. And that's exactly what's happening, I think, is that her eyeballs aren't lining up properly. So she'd have to get swelling in the morning. And I don't know about you, but as I've gotten older, I get little puffy bags under my eyes every morning. And they go away after about 15 minutes because the moisture drains out of my eyeballs. But when I'm lying down at night, it accumulates there. So some moisture could be accumulating in the muscle.
So she gets this when the muscle's tired and can't work anymore, and gives up on her. Does she use Botox?
No.
Okay. Because people with Botox, that's a complication that can sometimes occur with Botox injected into, for cosmetics reasons, into the face.
Yeah.
It's also why Botox was developed, to treat this. Because if you inject it into the muscle that's too short and weaken it, in other words, you take the strong muscle and weaken it, and now it and the weaker muscle can balance out. So the first thing we need to do with your friend is make sure she doesn't have a malignancy, which is unlikely, but somebody should maybe get an MRI or a CT scan at least of her eyeballs. I'd prefer an MRI because of the radiation, and look and see if there's a growth or an enlargement of one of the muscles. And then an ophthalmologist, not an optometrist, can actually go in there and fix this by selectively weakening the stronger muscle, the opposing muscle. And if you get that right, then the muscle that's working so hard, trying to balance against the stronger muscle, you weaken that stronger muscle, and now it won't have to work so hard, and you should be able to maintain your focus during the day and even in the evening.
And that would be done with a Botox injection?
That'd be the usual way,
Okay. She spends a lot of time on the computer.
That probably aggravates it because it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to focus. When you're focusing on something up close, you're bending the eyeballs inward. And when you're looking at the horizon, the eyeballs are at rest.
Well, there you are. So we should be getting out more and looking at the ocean and so on, and the mountains.
Yep, that's right. And what she could do during the day that would probably help would literally be take a break frequently, maybe every half hour, and go look at the horizon. Mm-hmm. Give the muscle a break.
Yeah.
And that might be all she needs.
So you think an MRI would be the better of the two?
I just don't. Yeah, I've gotten to the point where what I want is I want to push the United States government and the health, and ideally the United States government or the states individually, to make MRIs cheaper. I think MRIs are a great technology. There doesn't seem to be a lot of downside as opposed to the radiation that's involved in a CT scan. Why don't we do MRIs for every woman with breast cancer history? You know, why aren't we doing an MRI on the opposite breast? Because they're too expensive. Well, we can fix that. We just buy the MRIs with our tax dollars at work. We certainly buy enough useless equipment with our tax dollars. And let's set up an MRI center, you know, every, pick a number, 10 million people, 30 million people. Somebody with a calculator can figure out what it needs to be. But you just have MRI centers. And yeah, you travel for 2 hours and you know on, you know, Thursday the 25th in 3 months, you've got your MRI for your breast and you go and you get it. And that's that. I mean, we just have to decide as a society what we value, and then tell our, well, we have to first elect Congress people who will actually listen to us, but that's another story. Anyway.
What about muscle? What about exercises? Do you think the muscle, eye exercises won't help at all?
Well, I think that she's exhausting her muscle. And so, no,
right.
I don't. I think her muscle is just saying, okay, enough already. I'm done.
All right. Mm-hmm. I'm over. Okay.
Yeah. So I think eye rest, frequent breaks in eye rest would be where I would be going.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good luck to your friend. Please call us back and let us know if that if the eye rest thing works. I'd love to know that.
I will.
All right. Thank you. We had an off-air caller who had double vision, and it turned out to be myasthenia gravis. I would say that that's a possibility. However, our caller had very long-term problems and problems in the morning, which would not be consistent with that diagnosis. However, it is worth getting the blood test for myasthenia gravis, which is an autoimmune disease where you have antibodies attacking muscle cells, and double vision is an early symptom of that. So thanks, caller, for bringing that into the differential. Here's an interesting story. Who knew? For a couple of years now, researchers have been trying to develop nasal insulin with the idea that, well, we could squirt the insulin in our nose before we eat and we wouldn't have to inject ourselves. And it's actually turned out to be fairly difficult to get that to work. But while they were doing that, they discovered something very interesting about nasal insulin, which is that nasal insulin seems to improve cognitive functioning in Alzheimer's patients. And this is a very early study. It's just come out. The research director is Lori Ryan, PhD, and she works at the NIH. She's quoted as saying this is exciting new research. The lead researcher, and this is University of Washington and Puget Sound Healthcare System in Seattle, is Susan Kraft. So if you want to go look up the study. But essentially, we know that in the brains of people with Alzheimer's, the insulin level and the activity is lower. Well, obviously, insulin is what allows you to absorb glucose, and glucose is the fuel that drives the neurons. So if the neurons don't have enough energy, that could certainly explain why they aren't firing off so well and in such a coordinated fashion. When you use intranasal insulin, at least the form they used in this study, you don't actually get a lot into the bloodstream and it doesn't drop the glucose levels. And they were using doses of 20 units, 40 units, or a saline placebo, and having people snort the insulin four times a day, and they did cognitive testing. It was a statistically significant improvement in the group using 20 units of insulin a day. And it's preliminary. It has to be replicated. Cognitive testing in Alzheimer's patients is messy. And in fact, this may be a false alarm because the 40-unit group did not reach statistical significance, although there was a trend in that direction. Now, they were able to show on functional MRI that the use of the nasal insulin improved hypometabolism, that is to say, low, otherwise consider this to be not enough glucose, so they're not burning glucose. Well, the areas of the brain, if you measure how much glucose they're burning, they burn more glucose when you use the intranasal insulin, and the cognitive functioning lights up. So this might be a way of at least patching what's broken. This isn't a cure for Alzheimer's, and it's not going probably to work long-term in any kind of preventative way, but it might be a way of boosting the cells. Now, the big question is, if you boost the metabolism of these cells, do you speed up the progression of the Alzheimer's? In other words, long-term, is this a good idea? Answer to that, stay tuned, to be continued. We have an off-air comment. I want to read that to you. Was driving in the desert and the eyes began to ache. Saw a TV show about Eskimos put black around the eyes to reduce light reflecting into the eye. What can I do to reduce eye strain when driving in bright light in the desert? Well, sunglasses, window tinting, anything that causes your pupil to be able to dilate. Now, the eyes aching in bright light is a different muscle. It's not these rectus muscles that act like the reins on a horse. It's a circular muscle called the ciliary muscle that controls the size of your pupil. It's a big sphincter muscle, like a drawstring on a drawstring bag. And if you are keeping the pupil very, very tiny because there's a whole lot of light coming in, for photographers, you would say that you've got a very, very high f-stop on your pupil because you'd want to limit the amount of light coming in. It's a bright light situation. That makes it hard to maintain because that muscle gets tired. And especially if you're driving and you're keeping your eyes on the road, you're not letting the eye rest. The poor pupil is having to stay tight and it starts to cramp. It's basically a muscle cramp. So what do? You reduce the amount of light coming in. I bet you the Eskimos use sunglasses now. I think the black around the eyes reduces reflection from the surrounding structures of the eye socket and the orbit. And I've seen military people do that as well. And I don't know if that's just because it's cool to put on face paint before you go to war or whether or not there's a functional advantage to that. But I do remember that as a kind of stereotype from all the World War II movies I watched growing up. Presumably it's adaptive in some way. But I think it's probably just reducing reflection, and the ambient light coming in is still going to be pretty bright. I think it's more about allowing the refraction to not interfere with the image on the retina, reducing glare, in other words. But I don't think that it helps with the pupil not aching after hours and hours of trying to maintain itself closed in a bright light situation. Another interesting study that came up here, this one off of the Ivanhoe.com medical breakthrough section. And this is a very good website for lots and lots of stories around various types of healthcare. Many, many different articles. This one is sourced from the Journal of Physiology. It was published online September 9th, 2011. It's a study looking at maternal diet and allergies in the children or the infants. These researchers were using pigs, and we think that the pig intestine and pig development is very close to human development. We're both mammals, after all, share a lot of characteristics. And importantly, if you look at embryos and fetuses of pigs, they are very, very close to human. They're hard to tell apart, actually, until quite late in gestation. That's visibly, but it turns out that internally and at the physiologic level, there's a whole lot of similarity too. So this is a little leap of logic, and I want to caution us about that. But what the researchers found is interesting and somewhat paradoxical until you think it through. Certain kinds of polyunsaturated fatty acids, the omega-3s, and of course, you know I'm a great omega-3 fan, so fish oils, walnut oils, flaxseed oils, cause the fetal gut to develop differently. The guts of infants whose mothers are fed these sorts of omega-3 fatty acids are more permeable at birth. This allows bacteria and food substances to easily pass through the lining of the gut and into the bloodstream. Now, at the first thought, you'd think, well, that should make them more allergic because the immune system is being exposed to more antigens, a classic leaky gut sort of syndrome. But in infancy, we have something very, very different going on than in adulthood. In infancy, we have a thymus. The thymus is a large gland in infants. In fact, you can sometimes get an x-ray of an infant. As a medical student, we're often fooled by this. And there's this huge thing in the middle of the chest, and you think you're looking at a heart malformation. But actually, what you're looking at is the gland that trains our body not to attack itself. In other words, most autoimmune diseases would occur spontaneously in our bodies if we didn't have a thymus. The thymus strains the blood, and anytime we start to develop self-T cells that are sensitized to our own antigens, it says, nope, sorry, SWAT, you go away. Go to sleep. We don't need you. Don't clone. Don't reproduce. So we teach ourselves what not to be allergic to in infancy. So it makes sense. If your gut is more permeable, this gets in and it learns, your thymus learns you not to be allergic to yourself or to friendly gut bacteria or to foods. And the absence of that permeability could allow for an inappropriate development of allergies down the line. So very intriguing research. And I hope that it is carried further and done in humans and that they can establish gut permeability differentials in human infants. I want to also point out that this dovetails nicely with the research we have about using probiotics in the mother and also in the infant to prevent the development of food allergies or eczema in prone families where, let's suppose, you have older siblings who have this condition. So the studies are done on high-risk families. But I think it's probably true of low-risk families as well. It's just harder to show a statistically significant benefit. Lots of emails to go to. This one from Mary in Cincinnati. Dear Dr. Don, love your show. I listen to it on my iPhone. My son, a physician, has a severe fungal problem on his skin. He had athlete's foot and fungal toes. He's used internal drugs and external creams as well as vinegar and tea tree oil. What do you suggest for long-term prevention, treatment, and cure without continued use of drugs? My thought is his diet needs to be improved too. He's underweight and avoids sugar and alcohol. I'd love to hear from you. I love that last line, you know, there's a mom for you. His diet needs to be improved. He doesn't weigh enough. It's such a mom thing to say. Anyway, back to my response. Since you mentioned his feet, I would postulate that, and this is true for many people with toe fungus, that you have a immune system issue of some sort. There are a couple of things that I've been interested in investigating lately, and one of them is natural killer cell activity. The infertility doctors are way ahead of the rest of us in terms of testing things, and they've studied all kinds of lab tests trying to sort out what's the source of different types of infertility, and of course, they've got lots of funding, right? They've got people who are really desperate to have babies who will get out the Visa card, and why can't I have a baby? What can I do about it? These are important issues that people will put discretionary money into. Forget about the health plan. From their standpoint, you having a baby is not good for their bottom line. So it's a fertile ground for research, if you'll pardon the pun. Natural cell killer activity is associated with early abortions. There is a fairly common issue there where people have too much or too little NK killer cell activity. I'm thinking that the fungal issues that many individuals have where they can't quite fight off fungus may be related to NK killer cell activity, since this is the part of the innate immune system that attacks funguses. So he could get his levels tested just to follow up that hypothesis. Environmental manipulation is probably your son's best bet. What is the thing about feet that is different than hands? Well, feet are enclosed in tight little boxes and they sweat. So we've got a nice, warm, moist environment all the time. So maybe using sandals and ventilated shoes. I would also throw in the idea that there are socks that you can get that are impregnated with silver. And silver does have an antifungal effect, so it might help in terms of preventing the fungus from getting onto the skin. I don't think that silver would help much for the nails, because I don't think it'll penetrate well. If your son has low natural killer cell activity, there is a natural substance that will raise NK killer cell activity, and this has been scientifically demonstrated actually in cancer patients, oddly enough. But L-glutamine, which is a amino acid, if it's taken at levels of 5,000 milligrams or 5 grams or so, which is not a huge dose, raises NK killer cell activity and is used as a natural management for cancer patients, possibly your son could benefit as well. Let's go to our next caller. It's Edward in Santa Cruz. Hello, Edward, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
What can I do for you?
Yes, ma'am. The question I have for you is, I've had like sort of hereditary bad gums growing up and as a youth, and so the dentist told me years ago that I would have strong teeth, but my gums weren't that good. So throughout the years, my gums have been deteriorating, and I'm like 57 years of age. And so what happened is this friend of mine told me to go get some grapefruit extract.
Grapefruit seed,
and I went
seed
and got
extract,
it from this,
yeah.
Company, mm-hmm. And it says to dilute it in water, which I did, and to rinse your mouth out with it. And what happened is it made my mouth swell up, and it turned my gums white. And the bottom of my gums inside of my mouth, which were pretty much had been receding, deep receding more. And what it did is it's like making this white film come onto my gums, and it's like, I guess, causing my gums and my to treat it at the bottom in my mouth, but at the top of my mouth is just solid white inside.
Okay. And I'm sorry, we lost a little bit of you. What's going on the bottom part of the gums?
The bottom part is where inside my mouth has been receding, the gums have.
The receding, they've been
really,
receding.
Really
okay, I got it. So when they say your teeth are strong, I think what they're meaning is that the roots are good and solid and you don't have a lot of tooth decay. And the problem is at the level of the gums. Does that sound right?
Yes, ma'am. That's right.
Okay. And grapefruit seed extract is an antibacterial. It has a pretty mm-hmm. strong antibacterial effect. The swelling to me, the whiteness, by the way, that's edema. So when the gums or when any tissue in your mouth loses its ability to keep out moisture, moisture floods in and you get swelling and it shows up as whiteness.
Okay.
So that's a reaction. I don't see it as a good reaction, and I think you might have a sensitivity to the grapefruit seed extract. This could be a kind of negative reaction to the stuff. I don't see it as a positive thing for you to have, and I would urge you not to use it in the future.
Okay.
Have you tried massaging baking soda and peroxide into the gums? So baking soda and peroxide mix together into a paste, and you just massage that. Don't use a stiff brush or anything. Just use your finger, basically, and massage it into the bases of the gum. And another thing that can be really helpful for people with bad gums is actually probiotics.
What's probiotics? What
Those are the good bacteria that are supposed to live in your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
They share a lot of commonality with the good bacteria that are supposed to live in your mouth. Mm-hmm. What I would do is buy a probiotic that has a large variety of organisms in them, and you're looking particularly for types of streptococcus, because there are streptococcus bacteria that normally live in your mouth.
Streptococcus, and you say?
Strepto, like streptococcus. And you'll find that on the label on the back. and there are alpha streptococcuses that live in the mouth, and they're protective against gum disease. And so for people with recession, that's inflammation of the gums, I would definitely try this. The antibacterial properties of baking soda and peroxide are indiscriminate. So I would do the massage, maybe in the morning do the baking soda and peroxide, and then the evening rub in some powdered bacteria, the probiotics, and just rub that around the basis of the gums. Go to the health food store. Find the nice person with the tattoos and the mini piercings. You know the guy.
Yeah.
And ask him for probiotics and tell him you want something with streptococcus in it. And, you know, he'll take you over to the place where they have 60 different bottles of the stuff. And you want to find one in the refrigerated area and start reading labels. Take a magnifying glass because they print those labels really small.
Okay. So what am I looking for again once I go there?
Once you go there, they're called probiotics.
Yeah, I'm saying, but once I get the bottle, you say read it. What am I looking for?
You're looking for those streptococcus bacteria.
Streptococcus bacteria. Yeah. That's what it should say on it.
Yeah, on the back in little letters. And there'll be maybe 20 different bacteria, and you're trying to find one that has at least one or possibly two species of streptococcus, because that's the guy that's good for the gums.
Okay, let me ask you one other thing. I would say the bottom of my mouth on the inside, what it did is it's sort of like it's taking away some of the skin and the gum.
Yeah, you're definitely having a bad reaction.
Yeah, I definitely am. So I'm trying to like figure out, will that ever grow back or no?
Oh, yeah, that'll grow back.
Oh, okay, great. So let me ask you about the peroxide and the baking soda. Am I mixing that?
Make a paste. Just make a paste. Take some baking soda, throw some peroxide on it until you've got something about the consistency of toothpaste, and then rub it on there.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Call me back. Let me know how you respond, okay?
Okay, I will. I'll do that.
All right.
Bye-bye.
This definitely falls into the category of makes sense, worth a try. And it's really amazing how much medicine, for all of our white coats and our science and our statistics, when you really get down to it in clinical medicine, it's trial and error. You try something, it works, it doesn't work. We're very educated about what we should try and why. And I hope that I'm illustrating, as I do this program, some of the thought processes that a physician goes through in trying to break down a problem, understand what might be the factors contributing to it, and how we can interrupt or otherwise manipulate things in the direction of good health and healing. Another email, this one from Judith in Atlanta. A 55-year-old female friend of mine just contracted herpes. Not great, but she's handling it in a mature manner. Is there anything she can do to minimize recurrences and or build up her body's defenses? I hope you can inform your listeners that it is never a good idea to have sex, protected or not, before they and their partners are tested. Her partner had no symptoms and did not find out he was infected until she had a very painful breakout. And we had a second email. This was a follow-up email from the same person. After my friend contracted herpes at 55, I called Planned Parenthood and was told that the vaccine must be administered prior to someone turning 27. Is there any medical reason for this? And why wouldn't an uninfected older adult benefit? And the answer, Judith, is that you've confused HSV and HPV. HSV is herpes simplex virus. And then HPV is human papillomavirus, and the person you talked to at Planned Parenthood told you about human papillomavirus vaccine. There is, unfortunately, no herpes vaccine. The reason the HPV vaccine is not administered after the age of 27 is because our research was limited to people from those ages, and the concept is we're trying to prevent cervical cancer. And when it was given to people older than that, they didn't see a statistically significant benefit. And that, of course, is because people had already had sex enough times that they had been exposed to all of the human papillomavirus that the vaccinations were treating or protecting against. So you didn't get any protection. Now, if I had a 35-year-old Roman Catholic nun who had left the church and was going to be out there in the world and possibly being sexually active, I would totally vaccinate her with Gardasil or Cervarix because she doesn't have the exposure. She is as if she were a 15-year-old virgin. So why not? And that's true of women who have maybe been in a long-term relationship with one partner and they were both virgins when you started. Those are individuals that arguably would benefit from the vaccine. but you won't get your health insurance paying for it, probably. That's a separate issue. To get back to Judith's question, unfortunately, it is not practical to test your partners beforehand for herpes simplex virus. You'd be probably excluding a lot of partners, and it's a little bit difficult, I think, to say to someone, all right, I'm into you, but, you know, here's your lab form. Go get these tests and then give me a call. I just don't see people actually behaving that way. It's too high a bar. That being said, it is obviously possible for people to give herpes to others without ever having known that they had herpes. A person can have a low-grade exposure and occasionally shed virus. And when they do shed virus, their partner gets it and may have a rather flamboyant first attack of herpes. In fact, many people have flamboyant first attacks, and we have no idea how many people have stealth attacks, because how do we find them? But I can tell you that the prevalence of antibody positivity to herpes simplex virus type 2 in the population of people who do not give a history of ever having had herpes is at least 10%. So what do you do with that? Well, in the case of your friend, when people ask me this question, I generally recommend using long-term anti-herpes drugs at a low dose. So maybe 6 months or 12 months of Zovirax at a really low dose after the first attack as a suppressive agent so that they don't have another attack. And also to try and induce a long-term remission. Other things that are more natural, there's a good track record for lysine as an anti-herpes agent. There's very little good science behind it. It's mostly anecdotal. There's a couple of small studies, but it's a difficult study to do. And so given that lysine's relatively harmless, it's an amino acid, you eat it all the time, why not just eat more of it, so to speak, in a supplement? And the doses typically quoted for that are 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams per day. I don't think it's a problem. So she could go ahead and do that, and maybe that would help. In terms of stimulating the immune system, the standard suspects, right? Lots of sleep, good nutrition, good diet, all beneficial across the board. But I don't think that there are any specific immune stimulants that target herpes, at least none that I'm aware of. Anyone knows of some? I'd love to hear from you. We've got some off-air questions to my herpes question. There are people who say that we should watch sugar and coffee intake to reduce herpes. Also, the high sugar in some fruits and vegetables. Not sure about the scientific basis for that, but hey, you know, lore is lore, and I'm happy to transmit it. Another caller said, especially the coffee seems to be a factor, and also heard that high-fat nuts might increase the outbreaks. I'm thinking that that is, it's an interesting observation. I have no reason to believe it or disbelieve it, just passing it along. This email from Julie in Oregon. Osteoporosis. I'm postmenopausal and 54 and have had osteoporosis of the spine for 5 years. I have a history of a parathyroidectomy in 1997. And that, by the way, folks, means that she was pulling calcium out of her bones majorly fast back then in the 1990s because she was producing too much of a hormone that does that. And also 9 months of low-dose prednisone in 1990 after being diagnosed with lupus. And prednisone also burns calcium from your bones. So recent scans have shown worsening osteoporosis despite adequate calcium, vitamin D, and exercise. I'm intolerant of oral bisphosphonates, and MDs are recommending either Reclast or Prolia. Which would you recommend, and why? I love this last line here. As of today, my insurance company says they'll pay for the Prolia. My cost is only $25 a shot, but the Reclast is subject to my deductible, and they'll pay 80% after that $1,000. Not that that's my main concern, just FYI. Well, first of all, I would advise neither of the above. If you've got osteoporosis at 54, my suggestion is Forteo, which is for some reason not being recommended to you, and I think it's because your doctors are following algorithms that were written by drug companies and then somehow managed to make their way into medical practice. But they are not science-based algorithms, and they don't make sense in your case. The drugs Forteo actually builds bone, and it is, in a way, reversing the problem that you had because of your parathyroid overactivity back in the 1990s. So this would put the calcium back into the bone directly by playing a hormonal game. It's a hormone analog to calcitonin. And this is an injection. It's expensive, and you have to learn to do self-injection. So it has low appeal to the consumer. But I think it's an excellent drug, and you could take this for a year or two and rebuild your bone mass, and then you might be able to maintain it. The reason I'm kind of against the reclast, first of all, the cost for you is high. Secondly, reclast is a large dose of a bisphosphonate, and you're blasting your bones all at once with a big dose of something to try and prevent the bones from being broken down. Risks for osteonecrosis, which is when you get a chronic infection in your jawbone, and potentially risks for weird atypical fractures down the line. And we just don't have enough long-term data on the reclast to tell us that it's as safe as oral bisphosphonates, which themselves are none too safe in terms of their long-term problems. Now, is it better than a fracture? You bet. And it's all about risk-benefit. Now, the Prolia, it's interesting to me that that is cheap for you, $25 a shot, because that's an extremely expensive drug. That is actually a new class of anti-osteoporosis drugs. It is a monoclonal antibody. And those of you who listen to the shows know that I'm very cautious about monoclonals. I personally find the immune system fascinating. I love it. It's hugely complicated. I'm not even sure we can get our brains around it. It's so complicated. One thing I do know is that it's too complicated for us to be messing with it in a simplistic-minded, mechanistic manner with the paradigm that an agent that is an antibody is somehow just like a drug. I don't think so. And when you take a look at the drugs that we're using for, say, rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, these are serious autoimmune diseases with horrible, horrible suffering that results. Yes, give them a monoclonal antibody and help prevent that suffering, but know that there's a risk long-term of cancer and severe deadly infections getting going in these individuals. And you do it because the benefit matches the risk, outweighs the risk. Now, for the osteoporosis, using a drug that potentially could still have immunosuppressive effects, and who knows what else kind of effects, because we don't know what else we're targeting with this. I'm sorry, this is not ready for prime time. It's out there, you can get it, and obviously it's not getting traction in the market, which is why your insurance company is getting such a deep discount from the manufacturer. So woohoo, lucky you, you get a bargain. You get to pay only $25 a shot to be a guinea pig in a colossal experiment. And then, oh, 5-10 years from now, we'll know whether or not this was bad for you. No, honey, don't go there. Wait, sit on your hands. Talk to the doctors about the Forteo. I really think that this is an interesting illustration of where we've gone way too far down the primrose path on osteoporosis. Before we go to the next email, I want to tell you about an interesting scientific discovery about a gene that controls chronic pain. This was in the September 9th issue of the journal Science. And it's very preliminary, and of course, it's being spun in the press releases. Oh, wow, new target for new drugs. But I just think it's interesting from a scientific standpoint because it allows us to talk a little bit about the mechanism of pain. There are two kinds of pain, really. Inflammatory pain, which is a biochemical pain caused by persistent inflammation. And we're talking about prostaglandins, interleukins, bradykinin, other sorts of proteins that trigger pain by affecting the cells, causing the nerves to say ouch to the rest of the body, causing that sort of a I spill paint on the floor, I spill paint in the carpeting, and now I have to clean it up kind of pain. There's a second kind of pain, neuropathic pain. This is what happens when we're in pain for a long time. So when those receptors at the carpeting level continue to send a signal to the brain of pain, it goes through the spinal column. It's an interesting phenomenon, and it doesn't make a lot of sense why it should occur biologically. It seems maladaptive. You wear a trail, so to speak, through the spinal column and into the brain that is a facilitated pathway of communication. So now the flow of pain signal goes faster and stronger, and you actually start to get other types of sensory signals like temperature and light touch receptors that ordinarily do not fire off the pain pathways, actually rewire at the level of the spinal cord and start to fire off the pain pathways. And there's a really interesting discussion of this way back in the archives. If you want to listen to more about this, go to Ask Dr. Don. Go to the archives, look under interviews, and search for Dr. Lawrence Poree, P-O-R-E-E. This is an interview with a chronic pain specialist. He's actually locally based here down in Santa Cruz. He has a great discussion of this wind-up phenomenon and this development of spinal interneurons, which actually increase the amount of pain. Not only does this happen at the spinal cord, it actually happens in the brain. One of the reasons I do a lot of acupuncture in chronic pain patients is that you can step down this process with certain kinds of acupuncture technique. And just by the way, I want to emphasize, I have had this work on many people who said, well, acupuncture didn't work for my pain. And they were right. Regular acupuncture doesn't work on this. When you actually target this spinal column stuff, it's a hybridized form of electrophysiology plus acupuncture. And yes, it does work for this kind of chronic pain. The gene involved here is HCN2, and it is a piece of what's going on. It is an ion channel. In other words, you develop more ion channels, which are little tunnels in the cell, in this case a neuron. They allow that neuron to fire at a lower threshold. Just imagine that you have grains of salt coming in to a permeable membrane. And when the salt content reaches a certain level, that nerve's going to fire. Well, if you've only got two holes for the salt to come through, it's going to take a lot longer, or the salt concentration on the outside is going to have to be a lot higher for it to cause the nerve to trigger. But if you throw up a whole bunch of channels up there, more salt can get through, and therefore the channel is going to kick earlier. Now, this could be sodium, it could be chloride, it could be calcium. There are a lot of ion channels in our nerves. But this HCN2 gene is the ion channel gene that is being triggered. So if we can go in there and block it, or we can find drugs that block the stimulator, like NF-kappa B, we might be able to see a way of blocking the formation of this chronic pain or backing it off once it occurs. By the way, the date on that interview with Dr. Poree is March 25th, 2006, and there's an earlier one, May 24th, 2003. Let's go to Deborah in Santa Cruz. Hello, Deborah, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to thank you for the education that you do every week. I try to listen, and I learn so much. I was really surprised because I'm a nurse, and I actually think I know a lot about the drug companies, but this patient for the osteoporosis,
right.
I forgot the name of the drug.
Prolia.
Yeah, that's just amazing to me that that's part of the picture here. It's disgusting.
Well, that's my surmise because this is a hugely expensive drug.
Uh-huh.
I've never prescribed it for anybody for the reasons that I've just alluded to, but they're getting a deal here. The insurance company is definitely getting a deal, and it's the kind of deal that someone who doesn't understand the differences between the drugs, I mean, $1,000 versus $25.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible to get that insight.
They're recruiting patients.
I'm really happy you shared that. It's disturbing.
It's creepy.
It's horrible.
But if you're not creeped out by our healthcare system.
Oh, I am.
Well, you're a nurse, so of course you are.
I'm extremely creeped
out. But if you're not creeped out by all of these conflicts of interest that exist, then you're not paying attention.
It's terrible. It's really wrong. But so many people don't have time to do the research at all or anyway. But thank you for pointing that out. And I have a question about the Gardasil.
Yeah, go ahead.
What is your opinion about girls and this recent controversy over legislation, you know, that just came out last week about some people want to require young women to have this?
Oh, you mean the Rick Perry?
Yeah,
okay.
The safety of it. Do you have a comment on that?
Okay. There's been a lot of political pushback on vaccinations lately for a bunch of different reasons. You know, there's a large lobby of people who just don't like the concept of vaccination, and they're generally very liberal. And then there's this large body of people who don't like the concept of being told what to do, and they're generally, right-wing conservative branch. Oddly enough, you know, they say politics makes strange bedfellows, or this is one of those situations where both groups kind of have something to say about the subject of mandatory Gardasil vaccination. I will, I guess, kind of riff on it. There are a lot of issues here. Let's start with safety. No vaccine's absolutely safe. Mm-hmm. You don't get absolutely safe on this planet. So why we should expect that with vaccines, I don't know. So it's all risk-benefit. Cervical cancer is definitely something we would like to see go away. I have to admit, I have no objectivity whatsoever when it comes to cervical cancer because it's scary. I've seen people die of it. I spend a lot of my professional life screening for it. So the idea that I could eliminate it with a vaccine is very exciting to me. And at least for a while, we're going to be able, in this cohort of people that we vaccinate, to reduce their risk of cervical cancer. And maybe if we vaccinate the boys too, we'll be able to actually save an entire generation from having to deal with that. And we'll save some lives. The risk of the vaccine, mostly people faint. If you stick a needle in a teenage girl, they faint a lot of the time. That's not such a big deal. And some of the times when people faint, they jerk a little bit and that gets reported as a seizure. Some people probably do have a seizure when they faint, and therefore you could say, well, the vaccine caused the seizure, but really the injection is what caused the seizure. There hasn't been the emergence of any of the great bugbear, you know, this was going to cause this, that, and the other, you know, it's going to cause lupus, it's going to cause autoimmune disease. There hasn't been a surge, and we've vaccinated enough people now that we haven't had a long-term delay. We've only got maybe 3-4 year data, but we're not seeing a whole lot of anything cropping up in terms of long-term negative effects. So I think that the vaccines are safe, in quote marks. I think the risk-benefit ratio favors giving the vaccine. I wish the cost were lower because from a cost-effectiveness standpoint, it's an expensive vaccine. I'm glad it's covered by insurance because people will get it. I wish it were cheaper. As a society, we spend a lot of money screening for cervical cancer and treating cervical cancer. So the cost benefit for society, if we had national health care and everybody was in the same pot, it would make complete sense to vaccinate everybody. That being said, I still think this is a country founded on freedom. So where you're not presenting a risk to others, I think you should be allowed to forego a vaccine. And let me emphasize, if you're presenting a risk to other people, then we need to think about that a little more carefully. But this is a risk. You're just giving yourself the chance of getting cervical cancer. So I don't think that you can make the argument that you should be forced to do it in the way that, for example, if we have an infectious disease outbreak like the pertussis thing, I think it's completely legitimate for the government to say, look, you don't get to go to school without getting a pertussis vaccine because we're having a pertussis epidemic. Thank you very much. This is Dr. Dawn for now saying so long and stay healthy.